Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. I'm here in Columbia, Missouri for the True False Film Fest. I'm here with Festival Stalwart and curator of film at the Museum of the Moving Image and also a ringleader.
Ringleader. That's what they call the moderators.
Yes.
Here.
Eric Hines. Hello, Eric.
Good to be back. Good to be back in Columbia. Good to be back on the air with you.
Yes, indeed.
We are outside, just in case people hear some background. We are outside at the main sort of campus quad of University of Missouri. Even if there is a little bit of noise, it will be better than we experienced last year at this festival when we were outside in the rain.
Oh my God.
Doing a podcast.
Yeah, I actually had someone say, basically, did you have to record that outside? I was like, well, you listen to it. That's good, at least. So it chosen a more serene spot,
right?
To talk about this year, which is the 20th. First of all, the
20th.
Which is definitely like a milestone, a huge milestone.
Huge milestone. No, it's, I mean, I think we've talked about this a little bit before, is how there are these generation of smaller town festivals in America that kind of grew up around the same time. And 20th is a big deal. We are a well-established film festival if you've been around for 20 years.
Yeah. You know, one measure of the way things are thriving is, like, for example, having eight
world premieres. I think the most they've ever had.
And of a very, as well, we'll talk about, I mean, I think probably half of what we're going to talk about are drawn from there. So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, strong films, right? As you're saying, like sometimes festivals make claims of world premieres, but those films aren't necessarily the picks of the litter or anything. But these are these are very strong films that absolutely could be world premiering at any other festivals. It's actually really speaks well to True False's reputation and for the programming team that they landed these films.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess what we could start with is definitely like a highlight for the festival, Hummingbirds.
Mm-hmm. Which is not a world premiere, but it did just premiere in Berlin. But it's a U.S. premiere for a U.S. film, basically.
Yeah. And this is about two close friends. They're both Mexican-American. One of them is waiting for confirmation of her like visa package. And consequently, it's this amazing like split between they're just kind of hanging out, goofing off, also like doing little political actions, and that kind of thing just looming in the background, although it isn't like a TikTok movie where you're waiting for that, but you're just aware of that from early on.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of kind of amazingly free of narrative.
Yes.
Without being tough in any way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it plays beautifully. You really get to be in the present tense. Wherever they are, whatever they're doing, you're in the moment with them. And sometimes that's more of a kind of like montage type approach, but either way, it's a great watch without there being a story that you're not like waiting for graduation, you're not waiting for the immigration status to rectify. These things may or may not happen over the course of the film, but it's just, I mean, the only structuring element is where they introduce is like this notion of it being a summer, and I don't even know if it's all shot during summer. It probably is not. It's Laredo, Texas. It probably looks the same most of the time here. But that's the only, like, that's introduced in the beginning just to kind of give you a little bit of anchoring. But otherwise, it's the young subjects are also the directors of the film. It seems apparent to me that there's significant collaboration going on with more experienced cinematographer and producers and editors. Nevertheless, the filmmakers / subjects have spoken about how what you're saying is how intentional it was to not foreground the politics, to not foreground the struggles, that what they were looking to do was sort of present a sort of notion of joy and pleasure and, you know, the sort of thing you don't normally see with characters that are of their age in their location with their ethnicity. And it works on that level. It really is kind of a joyous experience.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it's not to be a third wheel, but I sort of feel like I'm hanging out with them. That's the feel of it, you know. But it is funny because to me it's incredible that they are also like the filmmakers, only because it's, I don't know how you do something that feels, I guess as you say, that, you know, they have a team that they work with, but that's hard, you know, I mean, and I don't know how much there is like a performative aspect or not for that. I mean, there are points where it's like, obviously this required setup, like even the, you know, in the opening sequence where they're stargazing and it's like, oh, we see the stars and then we see them. But in order to see them, there must be a camera looking down at them as they're lying on a car. Although they then turn that almost into a joke.
Exactly.
No,
I mean, I think there are a lot of setups there that are well planned. But I think that are well planned, you know, where the filmmakers are saying, we're going to do this, so follow us here, or vice versa, who knows. But I mean, the film that actually made me, that I thought of was Only the Young, which was a true false premiere. I think 12 years ago, 11 years ago, where it's a sort of a hangout movie where you're hanging out with kids. And there's even a couple shots in the film that actually
seem
very much invoking Only the Young, intentional or not. And as far as I'm concerned, that's extremely high praise.
Yeah. And just to jump back to the, I mean, the question of like politics, like how being politically active and outspoken is part of daily life. So, you know, part of their hanging out involves doing a protest that it's like on the border being a protest and a prank involving like abortion. And then they also have like this recurring joke about when they're doing like little races on the sidewalk, they're like, last one, there's a Republican. Which I have to say, you know, it's interesting watching that here in Colombia because that's a laugh line for this audience. So, you know, that was also another interesting facet, just getting a sense of them, you know, and you get a glimpse of, they could have bingo with, I forget which of their mother is at bingo, you know, and that mother is like a little, seems a little more restrained, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So it's, I always love getting a
sense watching of them play bingo is actually really fun.
Yeah, it's if you're wondering where the still comes from, that if you ever see a still from this film, this is a movie that came recommended and definitely delivered. I mean, another one I can speak to a little bit, maybe Natalia, which, you know, for me was a big, big highlight of this year, by the co-director of Three Songs for Benazir. And I mean, what was just kind of interesting framing is that the short, you know, is filmed in Afghanistan, and this is filmed in the U.S., and that the subject is a 29-year-old novice nun, and she's basically trying to figure out whether she can go ahead and go through and make all the sacrifices and commitments that are involved in becoming a nun. And it's different from like any other movie touching upon monasteries or convents that I've seen, because she's like, she's an engineering student, you know, and she, you know, is, she's always saying like, I love men, you know, like I don't, I watched this movie like on tenterhooks kind of wondering like, yeah, I mean, how is she going to feel? Is she really going to go through? And she also, she's like a Trekkie or Trekkie adjacent, you know, so they show her watching Star Trek movies or Star Trek shows where they're talking about, you know, Star Trek moral conundrums. So it's this great kind of layering of like contemporary experience and the church, which is, it's not an evangelical, obviously, it's a Catholic sect. And it's one that is especially based around the bond between the nuns and Christ. I mean, obviously nuns, I guess, are brides of Christ. Their like central text is like the Song of Solomon, which is like this very like sensual, florid, literary cry from the heart, you know, like, which is incredible when they read and they sing it. And the whole thing is filmed in squared off black and white, which self-consciously puts it in a lineage of like religious art house films. But I actually didn't think of that at all when I was watching it. It just felt like a smart decision because it really has a way of clarifying your focus. And Natalia, she is just fascinating to watch and has, you know, the face that you live for as a documentarian or as a viewer, because she's just going through it all and she's showing you it all. So it's also just like an incredibly generous experience and a privilege to watch her as she goes through all of this. So I don't know. I'm really curious to see how people process this film. I thought it was great.
I can't wait. That's going to be my last viewing of the weekend.
Oh, wow.
So I look forward to that.
Hopefully you'll, that'll be a high note ending for you. But yeah, I mean, just an example. Yeah. Just the span of experience, but also like, very self-consciously about particular challenges and the compromises and the sacrifices expected of her. And what's traditional, what's progressive about all of it. So yeah, that's Natalia.
I'll just sort of bring out a couple of films that I know that you haven't seen. And
yes.
And preempt that with a few of these are actually going to be at First Look, the festival at Museum of the Moving Image in a week and a half or so.
Yeah, so this is actually, I should have preceded that this is in a way like a twofer because we're talking about true false movies, but a lot of the listeners will be able to see it at the Museum of the Moving Image. So at first look,
yeah, there's some overlap. And Chloe Trainer, the artistic director of True False, and I have been in touch for a while and sort of scheming, especially for a couple of these international films, how to bring a filmmaker and shuttle them from Columbia to New York and back, and then back home. So one being Three Women, which is a film from Ukraine, sort of a Ukraine-German co-production. It's a just delightful film about three women in this border area in the Carpathian Mountains where Ukraine borders Poland and I think Slovenia. This very small town, which the director explained he found because he was doing news stories and was assigned a news story for that area from filming very, very different than what the film actually was, and then had this desire to dig in and spend a little more time in this town and got to know these women. But what develops over the course of the film is not only is his voice in the film, but he kind of comes out from behind the camera and then spends a good portion of the last two-thirds of the film more directly working with the subjects. And it's something so organic about it that does not seem self-referential or meta. It just becomes almost impossible for him to capture this place and these people without being more involved. So I don't want to spoil it for you, Nick, or for anybody else, but there are some things that you've never seen a documentary filmmaker do in terms of eating, drinking, purchasing, etc. So, but it's just really wonderful. Like there's just the whole thing just feels, there's sort of an exuberance, but at the same time as it being, you know, like clear-eyed about the difficulties in the sort of impoverished place and resources at the same time, and loneliness of people who live in a very sort of hollowed out population and a population that's dominated by women. Without it sort of needing to be explicit, speaks to different life expectancies of the of men and women in that area of the world. But also about where there are jobs, and you know, there's a lot of stories of people going further afield to find work.
Okay.
And I guess one other one I'll say is was our talent show.
Oh yeah.
Which is
I've heard a lot about
film
that.
Set in a Prague art school, like the most renowned art school in Czech Republic, and it's sort of the full cycle of the process of choosing students to attend the art school. That year one, because I think all ages, basically young people do apply to get into the school. Yeah, everything from the kind of slush pile, submitting your work to making it to the second round and having interviews and doing some work on the ground. But it's entirely from the point of view of the faculty.
Okay.
And I think it, Graduation, the Claire Simon film is a clear parallel and I think influence. And I think without pushing things too hard, it's pretty much a full-on comedy.
Okay.
You know, it is, and it is also like an incredible snapshot, not only of right before the pandemic, I think it was made in January of 2020.
Oh, wow.
So like what the issues in play and the kind of preoccupations are not what they would be obviously now, or they would have been a year or two later. That said, it's also a snapshot of a real generation shift, kind of exhilarating to see even leftist queer dominated faculty still not knowing quite how to talk to young students and quite how to handle language and standards and pushback and to be sort of like the gatekeepers, and yet in some ways they're on the defense even as they're gatekeeping to admit into the school is just, it's quite funny.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's I've heard a lot of good things about that, and that's that's a first look title.
Yeah,
I have a couple more films left, but they're also like pretty heavy compared to we just like.
Oh, I think we had some lovely titles.
Yeah.
So let's shift over to another theme that we've identified in the festival, which is the joyous occasion of death.
Death. Well, just and mortality and just
mortality.
Like,
yes.
And I guess like corporeal existence.
Corporeal existence. That's
embodiment.
Embodiment. Yes.
And
which is a meaningful thing to make films about, certainly.
Yeah, and in some ways, like, one of, like, the central challenges of filmmaking, if I do say so myself. But yeah, I think I'm hemming and hawing just because this movie stares directly at something. Anyway, this movie is called Man on Earth, and it is a movie made in collaboration with its subject, who is a man with Parkinson's, a New York man. Although in the movie, he's staying with one of his sons.
Bob Rosenzweig is his name.
Who is clearly like a bit of a child of the 60s, but also seems to be like a celebrity bathroom designer. It doesn't go into a lot of that, but I just have to mention
there
that.
There are these details of, yeah, I know.
These amazing details.
I like that I was left with that without knowing too much more.
Yeah, yeah. It's not at a hook at all. It's just something he did. And he has made the decision that he is going to, you know, voluntarily undergo euthanasia, end of life.
And just clarify, he's from New York, but this is Washington State where this happens.
Yes. Yes. That's right. Yes, absolutely. So the movie is about the kind of the run up to that day, which involves, you know, seeing him with his son who's taking care of him, but is also a strong personality himself. And I think a lot of this movie rests on Bob Rosenzweig's iron will and openness.
Yeah.
And because there have been a fair number of movies, I guess a number of European movies, especially, I feel like, or European documentaries tracking someone. I just saw one at IDFA, for example. I mean, not explicitly like...
I know which one you're talking about, I didn't see that, no. Well, and but also Last Light Home, Andy Timoner's film.
Yes.
From last year as an assisted suicide film.
That's another one, yeah.
I feel like an essential part of this is, I mean, a film like Last Light Home is dependent on it being within the family. So a filmmaker's making a film about her own father, and there being obviously a sense of complicity and permission there. This film, it's Emile Corton Wilson, who's an Australian filmmaker, mm-hmm. Who has, it's not the first time he's made a film with sort of an elderly or infirm subject. And in order for it to work, you really need to almost have the consent being addressed on camera and frequently, which I think is important. And it is there.
Yeah, it is there, yeah.
You know, there's a sense of like him even saying, like, you're one of my sons now, or you're in the family, and because you're going to, you know, there's clearly a decision to invite Emile into this, not just because it's been petitioned, but more like there's a sort of shared sense of mission behind it.
Yeah. Well, how would we describe the mission? Like, for Rosenzweig, I mean, I guess, what do you think are his reasons for...
It's hard to say. I mean, it's interesting that that's not super explicit. I mean, I feel like... I could be wrong, but I think there's a sense of in the importance of witness there, mm-hmm. of there's something kind of eternal about witness. I also think that somewhat similar to Last Flight Home, because this is not legal in all the states,
mm-hmm.
a desire to make it clear that this is a viable, humane thing to do. And so him allowing us to see him really struggling is part of him making the assertion that there is nothing immoral or suspect about the ability for him to sort of say when.
Yeah, and it's a testament in a way. I mean, because he has a lot to say about his pain and about how totally frustrating it is. So it's also very collaborative in the sense that it's, in a way, the movie is in some ways like an extended monologue.
Yeah.
I can't think of it, you know. And he actually is very articulate and in a very to-the-point way about his experience.
And I like how it's not all about, which I think would feel voyeuristic if it was filled with regrets.
Right.
And there was some, like, he needed to atone, or it's kind of not. Like, some of that work has been done before we catch up to him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's this great sense of even, like, one son is taken care of and the other son's not physically present. And that could be a place of tension and friction. But instead, Bob is sort of like, it's fine. It's okay. It's where he's at.
Yeah.
Wherever he's at is okay. And, you know, I don't know. There's something really lovely about that. And so it also relieves you of having to sort of worry about your being witness to kind of a painful emotional end, when in fact it's much more like an elected end to end the physical pain.
Yeah. And at the same time, not shielding you from the arduous, or whatever the word would be, process of that. I mean, now we kind of shifted to the talking about like the final sequences of the movie, you know, involving saying farewell, for example.
Sure, sure.
I mean, in a way, they're almost like two really rough scenes.
Yeah.
One of them is just saying goodbye to one of his sons on the phone.
Yeah.
And I don't want to like spoiler alert, but no, that is, it's just a very raw moment.
Sure is.
And actually the Q&A for the film, the director sort of felt like he, at some level, had to explain someone was there with him, because otherwise the camera's just on him as he sort of collapses in the extremity of the emotion of the moment, the release of the moment, which to some extent he's been kind of talking, not away, but talking through, so you think, but then it just shows how it's one thing to talk about it and it's another thing to actually.
Absolutely, right. As ready as he is, as peace as he is, it doesn't make it remotely easy to say goodbye to people.
Because he can have made the decision in his head that, okay, I will say goodbye, but then the moment when he knows this is actually the last moment in this case where, you know, he'll be talking to that son. Yeah, so that's one thing. And then the other is that the movie tracks him in his final moments.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean like putting a tripod next to his bed.
Yeah, yeah.
After he's taken this concoction. Yeah. I don't know. What'd you think of that?
I mean, I think that's it's a difficult thing to watch. It's an extremely difficult thing to watch.
I mean, it shouldn't be easy.
No, exactly. No, it's a difficult thing to watch. But I think that is, in some ways, that's the deal. That's the deal made here. And Bob and his family would clearly have say over whether or not they thought there should be a cut. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's one of these things where I have to, because those choices were made amongst them, and who am I to be precious about this? It becomes about gratitude. I have to be grateful that I was allowed in that room, and grateful mm-hmm. to experience a version of loss of this person that I came to care about over the course of the film. Yeah. It doesn't mean that I enjoy it. It doesn't mean that it didn't fuck me up for the rest of the day. It absolutely did.
Yeah.
So it's hard to sort of, whatever, stump for it. But at the same time, like, I don't have issue with it. It's just not easy.
Yeah. I mean, we might be in a similar place there, because, I mean, this is something that I think has always been hard for me to see in a movie, anything close to moments of death. You know, I don't even know if it comes from a moral place so much as a place of, it's nothing sacred. No, just in the sense of, you can have a sense that the camera is just unable to capture the full import of that and what's happening within a person in that moment.
Yeah.
And in this case, he goes forward and he documents, I guess, is the simplest way
it's
I could say it.
Yeah.
You know, and he sets forth with that. And because of everything he's done before then, mm-hmm. it can be more than a voyeuristic thing. But it's unrelenting. Like, I feel like I shouldn't sugarcoat, because I have to explain how much it did strike me. You see his lips turn blue.
Right.
You know, it's an actual document of that.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I do think that it's similar. I think Last Flight Home, it's less about, oh, well, they all do this, Nick. It's more like, oh, that's interesting about the contract of a film about witnessing the last days of somebody mm-hmm. that seems to also include the last moments or the last mm-hmm. seconds, because that's also in Last Flight Home. It's also in How to Die in Oregon, the film from years ago,
oh, wow.
which was so...
Right.
taboo that it wouldn't get programmed, really. And I think that was sort of the similar idea, is that you were in the room.
Yeah. Is Last Fly Home euthanasia or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. California.
I feel like this is a movie I must have avoided for the very reason I'm talking about, but now I can go back.
Yeah. It's very good. It's very good. Yeah, yeah. But should we talk about another corporal, film that is not necessarily about death witnessing?
Yes. I guess.
Which is Claire Simone's Our Body, which was a Berlin, and I know that you talked about that as well. So on a podcast, there's no reason for us to get into that, but I walked out of the theater a couple hours ago, and it's sort of freshest in my mind. And
yeah.
another feeling of gratitude, I guess, mm-hmm. of being allowed into each of these hospital rooms to meet these people, and into Claire's own sort of personal space.
Yeah.
There's something about being allowed to witness things that I think is a huge part of what cinema can do,
mm-hmm.
and real gratitude for it. Yeah.
And also just cinema as a communal experience. I think it's very different watching one of these movies at home versus watching it in a theater with a lot of other people, each of which come with their whole train of history and experiences are not with it, you know, fresh or not. And yeah, there was definitely sobbing when I was watching Man on Earth. And
well, and Our Body reminded me a little bit of, I mean, probably it's just because he's on my mind because he was here during True False, which is Steve Bognar and Julia Reichert's A Line in the House,
yes,
which is another sort of epic length documentary kind of spent in a ward. And that was a cancer ward for children. Very difficult film, but also kind of in its own way inspiring and exhilarating the way that Our Body is, where, yeah, you've got families and patients who are very much allowing you into the most painful imaginable scenarios. That, you know, it's hard to recommend. At the same time, I absolutely recommend both of those films because they're like communal cinematic experiences unlike any other. And we should gather in a room and confront some of these things.
Yeah. And sort of going along with the corporal embodiment thing. Wait, what?
The corporal embodiment thing is a great phrase.
Yeah, I'm like I'm a cinephile politician. The whole corporal embodiment thing. Well, I mean, because I think about it in those terms, and that's Guapo-y.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Because it's a movie about a survivor of imprisonment in Paraguay under the Stroessner dictatorship, which lasted forever, and her recovery, which is, I mean, that's what we're watching. We watch her life, which a lot of it just seems very therapeutic. You know, she has herbs and plants and roots that she's working with in the forest, and the movie does just this amazing thing of having, like, in touch with her great pain and the painful memories, but also in touch with the serenity that she has managed to fashion out of that. And the reason it comes in mind with the embodiment is just the movie's very tactile. Like, the feeling of the herbs and roots, the soundscape. This movie has an incredible sound design. Great moments with her and her mother, who was also imprisoned. And there's a whole story there I won't simplify by rehashing here. You know, the word tactile gets maybe overused, but it's definitely a movie that gets into her experience.
Okay. Okay.
So, and it's a movie that I haven't heard a lot of people talk about here, I think because, you know, it seems like a very quiet, solitary kind of film, but it's also a debut feature, and I think it's incredible as such.
Wow.
I wanted to add that one in there.
Yeah.
But for our grand finale, we can end with...
Another
debut feature.
Yeah.
The finale that wasn't, fortunately. The world finale.
Or unfortunately, considering everything that happened after.
That's right.
Yeah, so Time Bomb Y2K.
Mm-hmm.
Fully archival film directed by Brian Becker and Marley McDonald, which had its world premiere here. And is, it's the Y2K documentary. So it kind of goes and retells the story that some of us lived through. Some of us were more aware at the time than others. You realize how, I mean, there are full adults that were not alive.
Yeah.
That's just kind of what it is. Yeah. There are people who make, you know, $20 million a year playing sports who were not alive
right
during that time. Anyway, so it sort of uses like a lot of news footage, a lot of home movies, a lot of other kind of popular media to kind of take you through what that was, how it played out, and just a little bit of kind of the week after.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of age, the two filmmakers are relatively young and younger than you and I are. And I knew that going in, and I was a little bit skeptical or a little worried that it was going to be a kind of kitsch fest, kind of making fun of people and how they dressed and how irrational we were to care about this thing. And it's actually not that. It's very entertaining. It's very funny. But also, I think it does give a good measured sense of what the deal was.
Yeah, this was a movie also I was a little apprehensive about. I was joking that if there's any movie that I don't want to see a fully found footage movie about, it would be Y2K because it's defined by the hype. So it's like, I would want the perspective of a talking head in this case. I don't care. But that's the kind of skill of assembly of the film. And I think one way they do kind of subvert your expectations with it is that the contemporary commentary that they embed in the film comes from sometimes unexpected places.
Oh, yeah.
And one touch that I love is that as they're running through all the fear mongering and, you know, the bloviating of news anchors like Peter Jennings, I grew up with, but sure. Like big difference between Peter Jennings and Dan Rather. I'll leave it at that. But they have this one, I guess it's
a lot of
like,
Brian Williams in this too.
But yeah, Brian Williams, yeah. They have this one panel show that I think is called Hype. I hope this is not like a well-known show that I don't know about.
No, I don't know this.
And it's all, you know, I think maybe they're teenagers or their 20s.
Yeah.
And they are like the most level-headed,
100%
best commentators in the entire movie.
Yeah, and they go back to them a couple times, which I love because they're so good.
Yeah, and I guess also, you know, they're young people of color as well, which is also significant, I feel, because of the other strands of the film, which are about right-wing white, you know, doomsday cultism.
Yep.
Is going on there, and you have samples of that as well.
No, they're the echoes of everything that came after are obvious and intentional, but also not, it's not hard to sell that. The footage is there, the phenomena is there, the stories are there. So right, in terms of like right-wing paranoia, conspiracy theories, there's a absolutely legitimate invocation of Osama bin Laden in that moment, you know, and there's, you know, and sort of the week after, you know, like I think it's a Peter Jennings or maybe Brian Williams that says, "Okay, now that the world didn't end and you know chaos didn't ensue, we have a presidential election we have to start looking to." And you're like, "Oh right, oh my God!" Like, 11 months later, we were dealing with you know like a really fucked up election that led to whatever, and it just keeps going from there. It's not hard, but I also like the frame that they chose, which was not to just sort of, which they could have done because the footage is there. Mm-hmm. Let's just do like the week of, or even the day of, they could have done. Instead, they actually do go back to 1996, and sort of set up the identification of this issue, and when it first started sort of coming into conversation. Mm-hmm. And what I like about that is 96 is that much closer to the beginning of the web.
Mm-hmm.
And people like really can't even grasp why this could even matter.
Yeah.
Whereas by 99, in some ways I feel like computer literacy and understanding of what computers do and how important they are to our lives was almost formed during the Y2K fear, because it was all over the like everything about exactly how the computers are programmed, why this was an issue, what happened in the 70s or the 60s that sort of created this issue.
Yeah,
like that became something that everybody had to encounter and understand, and I feel like that must have accelerated computer literacy or at least media literacy.
Yeah, it kind of been like an on ramp or something for also just the continued meshing of like consumer technology and consumer electronics in our lives, you know, like, I don't know, then immediately after that you have like Napster, all these other things that were just, you know, very widespread.
I also just love watching 90 minutes of SD footage, standard def, grainy, wonderful, like TV footage. Fantastic.
Yeah. A lot of error message bubbles coming up and stuff like that.
And with a couple like, you know, pops of like Johnny Mnemonic and Lawnmower Man thrown in there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I will say there is one thing about this movie that I've definitely had a conversation or two about, and that's the challenge that I think is, you know, is in play here still for me. And that's we talked a little bit about that, but like the generational challenge of footage.
Yeah.
People coming to this footage who have seen some of it when it was fresh or not, and how hard it can be to rework or resist the received narratives that are powerful in those footage. Because, I mean, it's really at the source. Like, news shows create the received narratives. They are and create the received narratives. And I think even for this film, I would say that that's not something I'm totally sure it always overcomes partly because the shape of the chronology, you know, follows that little bit. But I'm not sure it totally overcomes it.
For an archival film, how much do you want to represent how it was and how it went down, and how much do you want to kind of go beyond that or at times subvert that too?
And I mean, and that's an example of how the teenager panel, adolescent panel is a great example of like from the inside of the period kind of redoing that. And then they also have home video, which are important for just getting past the, what does Peter Watkins call it, the like monolith or the mono voice of media, so you get some of that and something lighthearted. So that stuff is really important. But you know, it's also it's interesting watching a documentary like this, because I immediately think of a lot of experimental movies. You know, we've probably both seen from like the 2000s, you know, where people were already playing with the kitsch in this film. So it's interesting to add that chapter to that as well. Is this a movie that's already with HBO, I think?
Yes, but exactly like what its plans are for festivals and all that, I think, is still TV. Early in the process.
Okay.
But yeah, I would imagine eventually it'll show up on HBO. But yeah, I mean, I'm kind of a blast watching it.
Yeah, it's like, you know, there's a certain eye candy kind of fun to it.
Yeah.
I just thought of two other movies I would talk about, but I think at a certain point I'm just going to be laundry listing my pleasures. So I'll leave it there, but I'm going to head off and still see, I think.
Yeah.
What do I have? Two or three more movies left?
You don't have to feel like you're being antisocial by going to a movie at this festival. It's part of how we all gather.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Festivals are a peculiar combination of antisocial and social.
Right.
And I will, because I don't want to make Eric have to shill for his own festival, but a number of these movies you can find at First Look at MOMI, which starts in a week and a half, March 15th to the 19th. We'll sign off there. Eric, a pleasure as always.
Pleasure indeed. Thanks, Nick, for having me.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with your host, Nicholas Rapold. Please consider signing up at rapold.substack.com. Special thanks to the Minarets for the opening music. Thank you for listening.